16. In the fall of 1977, during the first quarter of his senior year, Todd joined the rifle club. By June of 1978, he had qualified as a marksman. He made all-conference in football again, won 5 and lost 1 during the baseball season, the loss coming as the result of 2 errors and 1 unearned run, and made the 3rd highest merit scholarship score in the school's history. He applied to Berkeley and was promptly accepted. By April, he knew he would either be valedictorian or salutatorian on graduation night. He very badly wanted to be valedictorian. During the latter half of his senior year, an odd impulse came on him, one which was as frightening to Todd as it was irrational. He seemed to be clearly and firmly in control of it, and that, at least, was comforting, but that such a thought should have occurred at all was scary. He had made an arrangement with life. He had worked things out. His life was much like his mother's bright and sunshiny kitchen, where all the surfaces were dressed in chrome, formica, or stainless steel. A place where everything worked when you pressed the buttons. There were deep and dark cupboards in this kitchen, of course, but many things could be stored in them, and their doors still be closed. This new impulse reminded him of the dream in which he had come home to discover the dead and bleeding wino in his mother's clean, well-lighted place. It was as if, in the bright and careful arrangement he had made, in that place for everything and everything in its place kitchen of his mind, a dark and bloody intruder now lurched and shambled, looking for a place to die conspicuously. A quarter of a mile from the Bowden house was the freeway, running 8 lanes wide. A steep and brushy bank led down to it. There was plenty of good cover on the bank. His father had given him a Winchester 30-30 for Christmas, and it had a removable telescopic sight. During rush hour, when all 8 lanes were jammed, he could pick a spot on that bank and, why, he could easily... do what? Commit suicide? Destroy everything he had worked for these last 4 years? Say what? No, sir. No, ma'am. No way. It is, as they say, to laugh. Sure it was. But the impulse remained. One Saturday, a few weeks before his high school graduation, Todd cased the 30-30 after carefully emptying the magazine. He put the rifle in the back seat of his father's new toy, a used Porsche. He drove to the spot where the brushy slope dropped steeply down to the freeway. His mother and father had taken the station wagon and had driven to L.A. for the weekend. Dick, now a full partner, would be holding discussions with the Hyatt people about a new Reno hotel. Todd's heart bumped in his chest, and his mouth was full of sour electric spit as he worked his way down the grade with the cased rifle in his arms. He came to a fallen tree and sat cross-legged behind it. He uncased the rifle and laid it on the dead tree's smooth trunk. A branch jutting off at an angle made a nice rest for the barrel. He snugged the butt plate into the hollow of his right shoulder and peered into the telescopic sight. Stupid! His mind screamed at him. Boy, this is really stupid. If someone sees you, it's not going to matter if the gun's loaded or not. You'll get in plenty of trouble, maybe even end up with some chippy shooting at you. It was mid-morning, and the Saturday traffic was light. He settled the crosshairs on a woman behind the wheel of a blue Toyota. The woman's window was half open, and the round collar of her sleeveless blouse was fluttering. Todd centered the crosshairs on her temple and dry-fired. It was bad for the firing ping, but what the fuck? Pow, he whispered, as the Toyota disappeared beneath the underpass half a mile up from the slope where Todd sat. He swallowed around a lump that tasted like a stuck-together mass of pennies. Here came a man behind the wheel of a Subaru Brat pickup truck. This man had a scuzzy-looking gray beard and was wearing a San Diego Padres baseball hat. You're a dirty rat. The dirty rat that shot my brother. Todd whispered, giggling a little, and dry-fired the 30-30 again. He shot at 5 others, the impotent snap of the hammer spoiling the illusion at the end of each kill. Then he cased the rifle again. He carried it back up the slope, bending low to keep from being seen. He put it into the back of the Porsche. There was a dry, hot pounding in his temples. He drove home, went up to his room, masturbated. 17. The stew bum was wearing a ragged, unraveling reindeer sweater that looked so startling it almost seemed surreal here in Southern California. He also wore Seaman's issue blue jeans, which were out at the knees, showing white, hairy flesh and a number of peeling scabs. He raised the jelly glass, Fred and Wilma, Barney and Betty dancing around the rim in what might have been some grotesque fertility rite, and tossed off the knock of ancient age at a gulp. He smacked his lips for the last time in this world.
"Mister, that hits the old spot. I don't mind saying so."
"I always enjoy a drink in the evening," Dusander agreed from behind him, and then rammed the butcher knife into the stew bum's neck. There was the sound of ripping gristle, a sound like a drumstick being torn enthusiastically from a freshly roasted chicken. The jelly glass fell from the stew bum's hand and onto the table. It rolled toward the edge, its movement enhancing the illusion that the cartoon characters on it were dancing. The stew bum threw his head back and tried to scream. Nothing came out but a hideous whistling sound. His eyes widened, widened, and then his head thumped soggily onto the red and white oilcloth check that covered Dusander's kitchen table. The stew bum's upper plate slithered halfway out of his mouth, like a semi-detachable grin. Dusander yanked the knife free. He had to use both hands to do it, and crossed to the kitchen sink. It was filled with hot water, lemon-fresh joy, and dirty supper dishes. The knife disappeared into a billow of citrus-smelling suds, like a very small fighter plane diving into a cloud. He crossed to the table again and paused there, resting one hand on the dead stewbum's shoulder while a spasm of coughing rattled through him. He took his handkerchief from his back pocket and spat yellowish-brown phlegm into it. He had been smoking too much lately. He always did when he was making up his mind to do another one. But this one had gone smoothly, really very smoothly. He had been afraid after the mess he had made with the last one that he might be tempting fate sorely to try it again. Now, if he hurried, he would still be able to watch the second half of Lawrence Welk. He bustled across the kitchen, opened the cellar door, and turned on the light switch. He went back to the sink and got the package of green plastic garbage bags from the cupboard beneath. He shook one out as he walked back to the slumped wino. Blood had run across the oilcloth in all directions. It had puddled in the wino's lap and on the hilly, faded linoleum. It would be on the chair, too, but all of those things would clean up. Dusander grabbed the stew bum by the hair and yanked his head up. It came with boneless ease, and a moment later the wino was lolling backwards, like a man about to get a pre-haircut shampoo. Dusander pulled the garbage bag down over the wino's head, over his shoulders, and down his arms to the elbows. That was as far as it would go. He unbuckled his late guest's belt and pulled it free of the fraying belt loops. He wrapped the belt around the garbage bag 2 or 3 inches above the elbows and buckled it tight. Plastic rustled. Dusander began to hum under his breath. The wino's feet were clad in scuffed and dirty hush puppies. They made a limp V on the floor as Dusander seized the belt and dragged the corpse toward the cellar door. Something white tumbled out of the plastic bag and clicked on the floor. It was the stew bum's upper plate, Dusander saw. He picked it up and stuffed it into one of the wino's front pockets. He laid the wino down in the cellar doorway, with his head now lolling backwards onto the second stair level. Dusander climbed around the body and gave it 3 healthy kicks. The body moved slightly on the first two, and the third sent it slithering bonelessly down the stairs. Halfway down, the feet flew up over the head, and the body executed an acrobatic roll. It belly-whopped onto the packed dirt of the cellar floor with a solid thud. One hush puppy flew off, and Dusander made a mental note to pick it up. He went down the stairs, skirted the body, and approached his tool bench. To the left of the bench, a spade, a rake, and a hoe leaned against the wall in a neat rank. Dusander selected the spade. A little exercise was good for an old man. A little exercise could make you feel young. The smell down here was not good, but it didn't bother him much. He limed the place once a month, once every 3 days after he had done one of his winos, and he had gotten a fan which he ran upstairs to keep the smell from permeating the house on the very warm, still days. Joseph Kramer, he remembered, had been fond of saying that the dead speak, but we hear them with our noses. Dusander picked a spot in the cellar's north corner and went to work. The dimensions of the grave were 2.5 feet by 6 feet. He had gotten to a depth of 2 feet, half deep enough, when the first paralyzing pain struck him in the chest like a shotgun blast. He straightened up, eyes flaring wide. Then the pain rolled down his arm. Unbelievable pain, as if an invisible hand had seized all the blood vessels in there and was now pulling them. He watched the spade tumble sideways and felt his knees buckle. For one horrible moment he felt sure that he was going to fall into the grave himself. Somehow he staggered backward 3 paces and sat down on his workbench with a plop. There was an expression of stupid surprise on his face. He could feel it, and he thought he must look like one of those silent movie comedians after he'd been hit by the swinging door or stepped in the cow paddy. He put his head down between his knees and gasped. 15 minutes crawled by. The pain had begun to abate somewhat, but he did not believe he would be able to stand. For the first time, he understood all the truths of old age which he had been spared until now. He was terrified almost to the point of whimpering. Death had brushed by him in this dank, smelly cellar. It had touched Dusander with the hem of its robe. It might be back for him yet, but he would not die down here, not if he could help it. He got up, hands still crossed on his chest as if to hold the fragile machinery together. He staggered across the open space between the workbench and the stairs. His left foot tripped over the dead wino's outstretched leg, and he went to his knees with a small cry. There was a sullen flare of pain in his chest. He looked up the stairs. The steep, steep stairs. 12 of them. The square of light at the top was mockingly distant. "Ein," Kurt Dusander said, and pulled himself grimly up onto the first stair level. "Zwei, drei, vier." It took him 20 minutes to reach the linoleum floor of the kitchen. Twice on the stairs the pain had threatened to come back, and both times Dusander had waited with his eyes closed to see what would happen, perfectly aware that if it came back as strongly as it had come upon him down there, he would probably die. Both times the pain had faded away again. He crawled across the kitchen floor to the table, avoiding the pools and streaks of blood which were now congealing. He got the bottle of ancient age, took a swallow, and closed his eyes. Something that had been cinched tight in his chest seemed to loosen a little. The pain faded a bit more. After another 5 minutes, he began to work his way slowly down the hall. His telephone sat on a small table halfway down. It was 9:15 when the phone rang in the Bowden house. Todd was sitting cross-legged on the couch, going over his notes for the trig final. Trig was a bitch for him, as all maths were, and probably always would be. His father was seated across the room, going through the checkbook stubs with a portable calculator on his lap and a mildly disbelieving expression on his face. Monica, closest to the phone, was watching the James Bond movie Todd had taped off HBO 2 evenings before. "Hello?" She listened. A faint frown touched her face, and she held the handset out to Todd. "It's Mr. Denker. He sounds excited about something, or upset." Todd's heart leaped into his throat, but his expression hardly changed. "Really?" He went to the phone and took it from her. "Hi, Mr. Denker." Dusander's voice was hoarse and short. "Come over right away, boy. I've had a heart attack. Quite a bad one, I think." "Gee," Todd said, trying to collect his flying thoughts, to see around the fear that now bulked huge in his own mind. "That's interesting, all right, but it's pretty late and I was studying." "I understand that you cannot talk," Dusander said in that harsh, almost barking voice. "But you can listen. I cannot call an ambulance or dial 222, boy. At least not yet. There is a mess here. I need help. And that means you need help." "Well, if you put it that way..." Todd's heartbeat had reached 120 beats a minute, but his face was calm, almost serene. Hadn't he known all along that a night like this would come? Yes, of course he had. "Tell your parents I've had a letter," Dusander said. "An important letter, you understand?" "Yeah, okay," Todd said. "Now we see, boy. We see what you are made of." "Sure," Todd said. He suddenly became aware that his mother was watching him instead of the movie, and he forced a stiff grin onto his face. "Bye." Dusander was saying something else now, but Todd hung up on it. I'm going over to Mr. Denker's for a while, he said, speaking to both of them but looking at his mother. That faint expression of concern was still on her face. Can I pick up anything for either of you at the store? Pipe cleaners for me and a small package of fiscal responsibility for your mother, Dick said. Very funny, Monica said. Todd, is Mr. Denker— What in the name of God did you get at Fielding's? Dick interrupted. That knick-knack shelf in the closet. I told you that. There's nothing wrong with Mr. Denker, is there, Todd? He sounded a little strange. There really are such things as knick-knack shelves? I thought those crazy women who write British mysteries made them up so there would always be a place where the killer could find a blunt instrument. Dick, can I get a word in edgeways? Sure, be my guest. But for the closet? He's okay, I guess, Todd said. He put on his letter jacket and zipped it up. But he was excited. He got a letter from a nephew of his in Hamburg or Dusseldorf or someplace. He hasn't heard from any of his people in years, and now he's got this letter and his eyes aren't good enough for him to read it. Well, isn't that a bitch, Dick said. Go on, Todd, get over there and ease the man's mind. I thought he had someone to read to him, Monica said. A new boy. He does, Todd said, suddenly hating his mother, hating the half-formed intuition he saw swimming in her eyes. Maybe he wasn't home, or maybe he couldn't come over this late. Oh, well. Go on, then, but be careful. I will. You don't need anything at the store? No. How's your studying for that calculus final going? It's trig, Todd said. Okay, I guess. I was just getting ready to call it a night. This was rather a large lie. You want to take the Porsche? Dick asked. No, I'll ride my bike. He wanted the extra 5 minutes to collect his thoughts and get his emotions under control, to try at least. And in his present state, he would probably drive the Porsche into a telephone pole. Strap your reflector patch on your knee, Monica said, and tell Mr. Denker hello for us. Okay. The doubt was still in his mother's eyes, but it was less evident now. He blew her a kiss and then went out to the garage where his bike, a racing-style Italian bike rather than a Schwinn now, was parked. His heart was still racing in his chest, and he felt a mad urge to take the 30-30 back into the house and shoot both of his parents, and then go down to the slope overlooking the freeway. No more worrying about Dusander, no more bad dreams, no more winos. He would shoot and shoot and shoot, only saving one bullet back for the end. Then reason came back to him, and he rode away toward Dusander's, his reflector patch revolving up and down just above his knee, his long blonde hair streaming back from his brow. Holy Christ! Todd nearly screamed. He was standing in the kitchen door. Dusander was slumped on his elbows, a china cup between them. Large drops of sweat stood out on his forehead. But it was not Dusander Todd was looking at. It was the blood. There seemed to be blood everywhere. It was puddled on the table, on the empty kitchen chair, on the floor. Where are you bleeding? Todd shouted, at last getting his frozen feet to move again. It seemed to him that he had been standing in the doorway for at least 1,000 years. This is the end, he was thinking. This is the absolute end of everything. The balloon is going up high, baby, all the way to the sky, baby, and it's toot-toot-tootsie goodbye. All the same, he was careful not to step in any of the blood. I thought you said you had a fucking heart attack. It's not my blood, Dusander muttered. What? Todd stopped. What did you say? Go downstairs. You will see what has to be done. What the hell is this? Todd asked. A sudden, terrible idea had come into his head. Don't waste our time, boy. I think you will not be too surprised at what you find downstairs. I think you have had experience in such matters as the one in my cellar. First-hand experience. Todd looked at him, unbelieving for another moment, and then he plunged down the cellar stairs two by two. His first look in the feeble yellow glow of the basement's only light made him think that Dusander had pushed a bag of garbage down here. Then he saw the protruding legs and the dirty hands held down at the sides by the cinched belt. Holy Christ, he repeated. But this time the words had no force at all. They emerged in a slight, skeletal whisper. He pressed the back of his right hand against lips that were as dry as sandpaper. He closed his eyes for a moment, and when he opened them again, he felt in control of himself at last. Todd started moving. He saw the spade handle protruding from a shallow hole in the far corner and understood at once what Dusander had been doing when his ticker had seized up. A moment later, he became fully aware of the cellar's fetid aroma. a smell like rotting tomatoes. He had smelled it before, but upstairs it was much fainter, and of course he hadn't been here very often over the past couple of years. Now he understood exactly what that smell meant, and for several moments he had to struggle with his gorge, a series of choked, gagging sounds, muffled by the hand he had clapped over his mouth and nose, came from him. Little by little, he got control of himself again. He seized the wino's legs and dragged him across to the edge of the hole. He dropped them, skidded sweat from his forehead with the heel of his left hand, and stood absolutely still for a moment, thinking harder than he ever had in his life. Then he seized the spade and began to deepen the hole. When it was 5 feet deep, he got out and shoved the derelict's body in with his foot. Todd stood at the edge of the grave, looking down. Tattered blue jeans, filthy, scab-encrusted hands. It was a stew bum, all right. The irony was almost funny. So funny a person could scream with laughter. He ran back upstairs. "How are you?" he asked Dusander. "I'll be all right. Have you taken care of it?" "I'm doing it, okay?" "Be quick, they're still up here. I'd like to find some pigs and feed you to them," Todd said, and went back down cellar before Dusander could reply. He had almost completely covered the wino when he began to think there was something wrong. He stared into the grave, grasping the spade's handle with one hand. The wino's legs stuck partway out of the mound of dirt, as did the tips of his feet. One old shoe, possibly a hush puppy, and one filthy athletic sock that might actually have been white around the time that Taft was president. One hush puppy? One? Todd half ran back around the furnace to the foot of the stairs. He glanced around wildly. A headache was beginning to thud against his temples, dull drill bits trying to work their way out. He spotted the old shoe 5 feet away, overturned in the shadow of some abandoned shelving. Todd grabbed it, ran back to the grave with it, and threw it in. Then he started to shovel again. He covered the shoe, the legs, everything. When all the dirt was back in the hole, he slammed the spade down repeatedly to tamp it. Then he grabbed the rake and ran it back and forth, trying to disguise the fact the earth here had been recently turned. Not much use. Without good camouflage, a hole that has been recently dug and then filled in always looks like a hole that has been recently dug and then filled in. Still, no one would have any occasion to come down here, would they? He and Dusander would damn well have to hope not. Todd ran back upstairs. He was starting to pant. Dusander's elbows had spread wide, and his head had sagged down to the table. His eyes were closed, the lids a shiny purple, the color of asters. "Dusander!" Todd shouted. There was a hot, juicy taste in his mouth, the taste of fear mixed with adrenaline and pulsing hot blood. "Don't you dare die on me, you old fuck!" "Keep your voice down," Dusander said without opening his eyes. "You'll have everyone on the block over here. Where's your cleaner? Less toil, top job, something like that. And rags, I need rags." "All that is under the sink." A lot of the blood had now dried on. Dusander raised his head and watched as Todd crawled across the floor, scrubbing first at the puddle on the linoleum, and then at the drips that had straggled down the legs of the chair the wino had been sitting in. The boy was biting compulsively at his lips, champing at them almost like a horse at a bit. At last the job was finished. The astringent smell of cleaner filled the room. "There is a box of old rags under the stairs," Dusander said. "Put those bloody ones on the bottom. Don't forget to wash your hands. I don't need your advice. You got me into this." "And did I? I must say you took hold well." For a moment the old mockery was in Dusander's voice, and then a bitter grimace pulled his face into a new shape. "Hurry!" Todd took care of the rags, then hurried up the cellar stairs for the last time. He looked nervously down the stairs for a moment, then snapped off the light and closed the door. He went to the sink, rolled up his sleeves, and washed in the hottest water he could stand. He plunged his hands into the suds and came up holding the butcher knife Dusander had used. "I'd like to cut your throat with this," Todd said grimly. "Yes, and then feed me to the pigs, I have no doubt of it." Todd rinsed the knife, dried it, and put it away. He did the rest of the dishes quickly, let the water out, and rinsed the sink. He looked at the clock as he dried his hands and saw it was 10:20. He went to the phone in the hallway, picked up the receiver, and looked at it thoughtfully. The idea that he had forgotten something, something as potentially damning as the wino's shoe, nagged unpleasantly at his mind. What? He didn't know. If not for the headache, he might be able to get it. The triple damned headache. It wasn't like him to forget things, and it was scary. He dialed 222, and after a single ring, a voice answered. This is Santa Donato MedQ. Do you have a medical problem? My name is Todd Bowden. I'm at 963 Claremont Street. I need an ambulance. What's the problem, son? It's my friend, Mr. D... He bit down on his lip so hard that it squirted blood, and for a moment he was lost, drowning in the pulses of pain from his head. Dusander. He had almost given this anonymous MedQ voice Dusander's real name. Calm down, son, the voice said. Take it slow and you will be fine. My friend, Mr. Denker, Todd said. I think he's had a heart attack. His symptoms? Todd began to give them, but the voice had heard enough as soon as Todd described the chest pain that had migrated to the left arm. He told Todd the ambulance would arrive in 10 to 20 minutes, depending on the traffic. Todd hung up and pressed the heels of his hands against his eyes. Did you get it? Dusander called weakly. Yes! Todd screamed. Yes, I got it! Yes, goddammit! Yes, 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 yes! Just shut up! He pressed his hands even harder against his eyes, creating first senseless star flashes of light and then a bright field of red. Get hold of yourself, Todd, baby. Get down, get funky, get cool, dig it. He opened his eyes and picked up the telephone again. Now the hard part. Now it was time to call home. Hello? Monica's soft, cultured voice in his ear. For a moment, just a moment, he saw himself slamming the muzzle of the 30-30 into her nose and pulling the trigger into the first flow of blood. It's Todd, Mommy. Let me talk to Dad, quick. He didn't call her Mommy anymore. He knew she would get that signal quicker than anything else, and she did. What's the matter? Is something wrong, Todd? Just let me talk to him. But what? The phone rattled and clunked. He heard his mother saying something to his father. Todd got ready. It's Mr. Denker, Daddy. It's a heart attack, I think. I'm pretty sure it is. Jesus! His father's voice lagged away for a moment, and Todd heard him repeating the information to his wife. Then he was back. He's still alive, as far as you can tell? He's alive, conscious. All right, thank God for that. Call an ambulance. I just did. 222? Yes. Good boy. How bad is he? Can you tell? I don't know, Dad. They said the ambulance would be here soon, but... I'm sort of scared. Can you come over and wait with me? You bet. Give me 4 minutes. Todd could hear his mother saying something else as his father hung up, breaking the connection. Todd replaced the receiver on his end. 4 minutes. 4 minutes to do anything that had been left undone. 4 minutes to remember whatever it was that had been forgotten. Or had he forgotten anything? Maybe it was just nerves. God, he wished he hadn't had to call his father. But it was the natural thing to do, wasn't it? Sure. Was there some natural thing that he hadn't done? Something... Oh, you shit for brains, he suddenly moaned, and bolted back into the kitchen. Dusander's head lay on the table, his eyes half open, sluggish. Dusander, Todd cried. He shook Dusander roughly, and the old man groaned. Wake up! Wake up, you stinking old bastard! What? Is it the ambulance? The letter! My father is coming over. He'll be here in no time. Where's the fucking letter? What? What letter? You told me to tell them you got an important letter. I said his heart sank. I said it came from overseas, from Germany. Christ! Todd ran his hands through his hair. A letter. Dusander raised his head with slow difficulty. His seamed cheeks were an unhealthy yellowish white, his lips blue. From Willie, I think. Willie Frankel, dear, dear Willie. Todd looked at his watch and saw that already 2 minutes had passed since he had hung up the phone. His father would not, could not, make it from their house to Dusander's in 4 minutes, but he could do it damn fast in the Porsche. Fast. That was it. Everything was moving too fast. And there was still something wrong here. He felt it. But there was no time to stop and hunt around for the loophole. Yes, okay. I was reading it to you, and you got excited and had this heart attack. Good. Where is it? Dusander looked at him blankly. The letter! Where is it? What letter? Dusander asked vacantly, and Todd's hands itched to throttle the drunken old monster. The one I was reading to you, the one from Willie What's-His-Face, where is it? They both looked at the table, as if expecting to see the letter materialize there. Upstairs, Dusander said finally. Look in my dresser, the third drawer. There is a small wooden box in the bottom of that drawer. You will have to break it open. I lost the key a long time ago. There are some very old letters from a friend of mine. None signed, none dated, all in German. A page or two will serve for window fittings, as you would say. If you hurry—" "Are you crazy?" Todd raged. "I don't understand German. How could I read you a letter written in German, you numb fuck?"
"Why would Willy write me in English?" Duzanda countered wearily. "If you read me the letter in German, I would understand it, even if you did not. And of course your pronunciation would be butchery, but still I could—"
Duzanda was right. Right again. And Todd didn't wait to hear more. Even after a heart attack, the old man was a step ahead. Todd raced down the hall to the stairs, pausing just long enough by the front door to make sure his father's Porsche wasn't pulling up even now. It wasn't, but Todd's watch told him just how tight things were getting. It had been 5 minutes now. He took the stairs two at a time and burst into Dusander's bedroom. He had never been up here before, hadn't even been curious, and for a moment he only looked wildly around at the unfamiliar territory. Then he saw the dresser, a cheap item done in the style his father called discount store modern. He fell on his knees in front of it and yanked at the third drawer. It came halfway out, then jigged sideways in its slot and stuck firmly.
"God damn you,"
he whispered at it. His face was dead pale except for the spots of dark bloody color flaring at each cheek and his blue eyes, which looked as dark as Atlantic storm clouds.
"God damn you fucking thing, come out!"
He yanked so hard that the entire dresser tottered forward and almost fell on him before deciding to settle back. The drawer shot all the way out and landed in Todd's lap. Dusander's socks and underwear and handkerchief spilled out all around him. He pawed through the stuff that was still in the drawer and came out with a wooden box about 9 inches long and 3 inches deep. He tried to pull up the lid. Nothing happened. It was locked, just as Dusander had said. Nothing was free tonight. He stuffed the spilled clothes back into the drawer and then rammed the drawer back into its oblong slot. It stuck again. Todd worked to free it, wiggling it back and forth, sweat running freely down his face. At last he was able to slam it shut. He got up with the box. How much time had passed now? Dusander's bed was the type with the posts at the foot, and Todd brought the lock side of the box down on one of these posts as hard as he could, grinning at the shock of pain that vibrated in his hands and traveled all the way up to his elbows. He looked at the lock. The lock looked a bit dented, but it was intact. He brought it down on the post again, even harder this time, heedless of the pain. This time a chunk of wood flew off the bedpost, but the lock still didn't give. Todd uttered a little shriek of laughter and took the box to the other end of the bed. He raised it high over his head this time and brought it down with all his strength. This time the lock splintered. As he flipped the lid up, headlights splashed across Dusander's window. He pawed wildly through the box, postcards, a locket, a much-folded picture of a woman wearing frilly black garters and nothing else, an old billfold, several sets of ID, an empty leather passport folder, at the bottom, letters. The lights grew brighter, and now we heard the distinctive beat of the Porsche's engine. It grew louder, and then cut off. Todd grabbed 3 sheets of airmail-type stationery, closely written in German on both sides of each sheet, and ran out of the room again. He had almost gotten to the stairs when he realized he had left the forced box lying on Dusander's bed. He ran back, grabbed it, and opened the third dresser drawer. It stuck again, this time with a firm shriek of wood against wood. Out front he heard the ratchet of the Porsche's emergency brake, the opening of the driver door, the slam shut. Faintly, Todd could hear himself moaning. He put the box in the askew drawer, stood up, and lashed out at it with his foot. The drawer closed neatly. He stood, blinking at it for a moment, and then fled back down the hall. He raced down the stairs. Halfway down them, he heard the rapid rattle of his father's shoes on Dusander's walk. Todd vaulted over the banister, landed lightly, and ran into the kitchen, the airmail pages fluttering from his hand. A hammering on the door. "Todd! Todd, it's me!" And he could hear an ambulance siren in the distance as well. Dusander had drifted away into semi-consciousness again. "Coming, Dad!" Todd shouted. He put the airmail pages on the table, fanning them a little as if they'd been dropped in a hurry, and then he went back down the hall and let his father in. "Where is he?" Dick Bowden asked, shouldering past Todd. "In the kitchen." "You did everything just right, Todd," his father said, and hugged him in a rough, embarrassed way. "I just hope I remembered everything," Todd said modestly, and then followed his father down the hall and into the kitchen. In the rush to get Dusander out of the house, the letter was almost completely ignored. Todd's father picked it up briefly, then put it down when the medics came in with the stretcher. Todd and his father followed the ambulance, and his explanation of what had happened was accepted without question by the doctor attending Dusander's case. Mr. Denker was, after all, 80 years old, and his habits were not the best. The doctor also offered Todd a brusque commendation for his quick thinking and action. Todd thanked him wanly, and then asked his father if they could go home. As they rode back, Dick told him again how proud of him he was. Todd barely heard him. He was thinking about his 30-30 again. 18. That was the same day Morris Heisel broke his back. Morris had never intended to break his back. All he had intended to do was nail up the corner of the rain gutter on the west side of his house. Breaking his back was the furthest thing from his mind. He had enough grief in his life without that, thank you very much. His first wife had died at the age of 25, and both of their daughters were also dead. His brother was dead, killed in a tragic car accident not far from Disneyland in 1971. Morris himself was nearing 60, and had a case of arthritis that was worsening early and fast. He also had warts on both hands, warts that seemed to grow back as fast as the doctor could burn them off. He was also prone to migraine headaches, and in the last couple of years that potser Rogan next door had taken to calling him Morris the Cat. Morris had wondered aloud to Lydia, his second wife, how Rogan would like it if Morris took up calling him Rogan the Hemorrhoid. "Quit it, Morris," Lydia said on these occasions. "You can't take a joke. You never could take a joke. Sometimes I wonder how I could marry a man with absolutely no sense of humor." "We go to Las Vegas," Lydia had said, addressing the empty kitchen as if an invisible horde of spectators, which only she could see, were standing there. "We see Buddy Hackett, and Morris doesn't laugh once." Besides arthritis, warts, and migraines, Morris also had Lydia, who, God love her, had developed into something of a nag over the last 5 years or so, ever since her hysterectomy. So he had plenty of sorrows and plenty of problems without adding a broken back. "Morris!" Lydia cried, coming to the back door and wiping suds from her hands with her dish towel. "Morris, you come down off that ladder right now!" "What?" He twisted his head so he could see her. He was almost at the top of his aluminum stepladder. There was a bright yellow sticker on this step which said, "Danger! Balance may shift without warning above this step." Morris was wearing his carpenter's apron with the wide pockets, one of the pockets filled with nails and the other filled with heavy-duty staples. The ground under the stepladder's feet was slightly uneven, and the ladder rocked a little when he moved. His neck ached with the unlovely prelude to one of his migraines. He was out of temper. "What? Come down from there," I said, "before you break your back." "I'm almost finished." "You're rocking on that ladder like you were on a boat, Morris. Come down." "I'll come down when I'm done," he said angrily. "Leave me alone." "You'll break your back," she reiterated dolefully, and went into the house again. 10 minutes later, as he was hammering the last nail into the rain gutter, tipped back nearly to the point of overbalancing, he heard a feline yowl, followed by fierce barking. "What in God's name?" He looked around, and the stepladder rocked alarmingly. At that same moment, their cat, it was named Loverboy, not Morris, tore around the corner of the garage, its fur bushed out into hackles and its green eyes flaring. The Rogan's collie pup was in hot pursuit, its tongue hanging out and its leash dragging behind it. Loverboy, apparently not superstitious, ran under the stepladder. The collie pup followed. "Look out! Look out, you dumb mutt!" Morris shouted. The ladder rocked. The pup bunted it with the side of its body. The ladder tipped over, and Morris tipped with it, uttering a howl of dismay. Nails and staples flew out of his carpenter's apron. He landed half on and half off the concrete driveway, and a gigantic agony flared in his back. He did not so much hear his spine snap as feel it happen. Then the world grayed out for a while. When things swam back into focus, he was still lying half on and half off the driveway in a litter of nails and staples. Lydia was kneeling over him, weeping. Rogan from next door was there, too, his face as white as a shroud. "I told you," Lydia babbled. "I told you to come down off that ladder. Now look! Now look at this!" Morris found he had absolutely no desire to look. A suffocating, throbbing band of pain had cinched itself around his middle like a belt, and that was bad. But there was something much worse. He could feel nothing below that belt of pain. Nothing at all. "Vail later," he said huskily. Call the doctor now. I'll do it, Rogan said, and ran back to his own house. Lydia, Morris said. He wet his lips. What? What, Morris? She bent over him, and a tear splashed on his cheek. It was touching, he supposed, but it had made him flinch, and the flinch had made the pain worse. Lydia, I also have one of my migraines. Oh, poor darling. Poor Morris. But I told you. I've got the headache because that Potzer Rogan's dog barked all night and kept me awake. Today the dog chases my cat and knocks over my ladder, and I think my back is broken. Lydia shrieked. The sound made Morris's head vibrate. Lydia, he said, and wet his lips again. What, darling? I have suspected something for many years. Now I am sure. My poor Morris, what? There is no God, Morris said, and fainted. They took him to Santo Donato, and his doctor told him, at about the same time that he would have ordinarily been sitting down to one of Lydia's wretched suppers, that he would never walk again. By then they had put him in a body cast. Blood and urine samples had been taken. Dr. Kemmelman had peered into his eyes and tapped his knees with a little rubber hammer, but no reflexive twitch of the leg answered the taps. And at every turn there was Lydia, the tears streaming from her eyes as she used up one handkerchief after another. Lydia, a woman who would have been at home married to Job, went everywhere well supplied with little lace snot rags, just in case reason for an extended crying spell should occur. She had called her mother, and her mother would be here soon. That's nice, Lydia, although if there was anyone on earth Morris honestly loathed, it was Lydia's mother. She had called the rabbi. He would be here soon, too. That's nice, Lydia, although he hadn't set foot inside the synagogue in 5 years and wasn't sure what the rabbi's name was. She had called his boss, and while he wouldn't be here soon, he sent his greatest sympathies and condolences. That's nice, Lydia. Although if there was anyone in a class with Lydia's mother, it was that cigar-chewing putz, Frank Haskell. At last, they gave Morris a Valium and took Lydia away. Shortly afterward, Morris just drifted away. No worries, no migraines, no nothing. If they kept giving him little blue pills like that, went his last thought, he would go up on that stepladder and break his back again. When he woke up, or regained consciousness, that was more like it, dawn was just breaking, and the hospital was as quiet as Morris supposed it ever got. He felt very calm, almost serene. He had no pain. His body felt swaddled and weightless. His bed had been surrounded by some sort of contraption, like a squirrel cage, a thing of stainless steel bars, guy wires, and pulleys. His legs were being held up by cables attached to this gadget. His back seemed to be bowed by something beneath, but it was hard to tell. He had only the angle of his vision to judge by. Others have it worse, he thought. All over the world others have it worse. In Israel, the Palestinians kill busloads of farmers who were committing the political crime of going into town to see a movie. The Israelis cope with this injustice by dropping bombs on the Palestinians and killing children along with whatever terrorists may be there. Others have it worse than me. Which is not to say this is good, don't get that idea, but others have it worse. He lifted one hand with some effort. There was pain somewhere in his body, but it was very faint, and made a weak fist in front of his eyes. There. Nothing wrong with his hands. Nothing wrong with his arms either. So he couldn't feel anything below the waist, so what? There were people all over the world paralyzed from the neck down. There were people with leprosy. There were people dying of syphilis. Somewhere in the world right now, there might be people walking down the jetway and onto a plane that was going to crash. No, this wasn't good. But there were worse things in the world. And there had been, once upon a time, much worse things in the world. He raised his left arm. It seemed to float, disembodied before his eyes, a scrawny old man's arm with the muscles deteriorating. He was in a hospital johnny, but it had short sleeves, and he could still read the numbers on the forearm, tattooed there in faded blue ink. P 499965214. Worse things, yes,
Worse things than falling off a suburban stepladder and breaking your back and being taken to a clean and sterile metropolitan hospital and being given a Valium that was guaranteed to bubble your troubles away. There were the showers. They were worse. His first wife, Ruth, had died in one of their filthy showers. There were the trenches that became graves. He could close his eyes and still see the men lined up along the open maw of the trenches, could still hear the volley of rifle fire, could still remember the way they flopped backwards into the earth like badly made puppets. There were the crematoriums. They were worse, too. The crematoriums that filled the air with the steady, sweet smell of Jews burning like torches no one could see. The horror-struck faces of old friends and relatives, faces that melted away like guttering candles, faces that seemed to melt away before your very eyes, thin, thinner, thinnest. Then one day they were gone. Where? Where does a torch flame go when the cold wind has blown it out? Heaven. Hell. Lights in the darkness. Candles in the wind. When Job finally broke down and questioned, God asked him, "Where were you when I made the world?" If Morris Heisel had been Job, he would have responded, "Where were you when my Ruth was dying? You potser, you! Watching the Yankees and the Senators? If you can't pay attention to your business better than this, get out of my face!" Yes, there were worse things than breaking your back, he had no doubt of it. But what sort of God would have allowed him to break his back and become paralyzed for life after watching his wife die and his daughters and his friends? No God at all. That was who. A tear trickled from the corner of his eye and ran slowly down the side of his head to his ear. Outside the hospital room, a bell rang softly. A nurse squeaked by on white crepe-soled shoes. His door was ajar, and on the far wall of the corridor outside he could read the letters N-S-I-V-E-C-A, and guess that the whole sign must read Intensive Care. There was movement in the room, a rustle of bedclothes. Moving very carefully, Morris turned his head to the right, away from the door. He saw a night table next to him with a pitcher of water on it. There were two call buttons on the table. Beyond it was another bed. And in the bed was a man who looked even older and sicker than Morris felt. He was not hooked into a giant exercise wheel for gerbils like Morris was, but an IV feed stood beside his bed and some sort of monitoring console stood at its foot. The man's skin was sunken and yellow. Lines around his mouth and eyes had driven deep. His hair was yellowish-white, dry and lifeless. His thin eyelids had a bruised and shiny look, and in his big nose Morris saw the burst capillaries of the lifelong drinker. Morris looked away, and then looked back. As the dawnlight grew stronger and the hospital began to wake up, he began to have the strangest feeling that he knew his roommate. Could that be? The man looked to be somewhere between 75 and 80, and Morris didn't believe he knew anyone quite that old. Except for Lydia's mother, a horror Morris sometimes believed to be older than the Sphinx, whom the woman closely resembled. Maybe the guy was someone he had known in his past. Maybe even before he, Morris, came to America. Maybe. Maybe not. And why all of a sudden did it seem to matter? For that matter, why had all his memories of the camp of Patton come flooding back tonight when he always tried to, and most times succeeded in, keeping those things buried? He broke out in a sudden rash of goose flesh, as if he had stepped into some mental, haunted house where old bodies were unquiet and old ghosts walked. Could that be? Even here and now, in this clean hospital, 30 years after those dark times had ended? He looked away from the old man in the other bed, and soon he had begun to feel sleepy again. It's a trick of your mind that this other man seems familiar. Only your mind amusing you in the best way it can, amusing you the way it used to try to amuse you in. But he would not think of that. He would not allow himself to think of that. Drifting into sleep, he thought of a boast he had made to Ruth.
But never to Lydia. It didn't pay to boast to Lydia. She was not like Ruth, who would always smile sweetly at his harmless puffing and crowing. I never forget a face. Here was his chance to find out if that was still so. If he had really known the man in the other bed at some time or other, perhaps he could remember when and where. Very close to sleep, drifting back and forth across its threshold, Morris thought, perhaps I knew him in the camp. That would be ironic indeed. What they called a jest of God. What God? Morris Heisel asked himself again, and slept. 19. Todd graduated salutatorian of his class, just possibly because of his poor grade on the trig final he had been studying for the night Dusander had had his heart attack. It dragged his final grade in the course down to 89, 1 point below an A-minus average. A week after graduation, the Bowdens went to visit Mr. Denker at Santo Donato General. Todd fidgeted through 15 minutes of banalities and thank yous and how do you feels, and was grateful for the break when the man in the other bed asked him if he could come over for a minute. "You'll pardon me," the other man said apologetically. He was in a huge body cast and was for some reason attached to an overhead system of pulleys and wires. "My name is Morris Heisel. I broke my back." "That's too bad," Todd said gravely. "Aye, too bad," he says. "This boy has the gift of understatement." Todd started to apologize, but Heisel raised his hand, smiling a little. His face was pale and tired, the face of any old man in the hospital, facing a life full of sweeping changes just ahead, and surely few of them for the better. In that way, Todd thought, he and Dusander were alike. "No need," Morris said, "no need to answer a rude comment. You are a stranger. Does a stranger need to be inflicted with my problems?" "No man is an island, entire of itself," Todd began, and Morris laughed. "Dunn," he quotes at me, "a smart kid. Your friend there, is he very bad off?" "Well, the doctors say he's doing fine, considering his age. He's 80. "That old?" Morris exclaimed. "He doesn't talk to me much, you know. But from what he does say, I guess he's naturalized. Like me. I'm Polish, you know. Originally, I mean, from Radom."
"Oh?" Todd said politely.
"Yes. Do you know what they call an orange manhole cover in Radom?"
"No," Todd said, smiling.
"Howard Johnson's," Morris said, and laughed. Todd laughed, too. Dusander glanced over at them, startled by the sound and frowning a little. Then Monica said something, and he looked back at her again. "Is your friend naturalized?"
"Oh, yes," Todd said.
"He's from Germany. Essen. Do you know that town?"
"No," Morris said.
"But I was only in Germany once. I wonder if he was in the war."
"I really couldn't say." Todd's eyes had gone distant.
"No? Well, it doesn't matter. That was a long time ago, the war. In another 3 years, there will be people in this country constitutionally eligible to become president. President! Who weren't even born until after the war was over. To them it must seem there is no difference between the miracle of Dunkirk and Hannibal taking his elephants over the Alps."
"Were you in the war?" Todd asked.
"Well, I suppose I was, in a manner of speaking." "You're a good boy to visit such an old man. Two old men, counting me," Todd smiled modestly.
"I'm tired now," Morris said. "Perhaps I'll sleep."
"I hope you feel better soon," Todd said. Morris nodded, smiled, and closed his eyes. Todd went back to Dusander's bed, where his parents were just getting ready to leave. His dad kept glancing at his watch and exclaiming with bluff heartiness at how late it was getting.
2 days later, Todd came back to the hospital alone. This time, Morris Heisel, immured in his body cast, was deeply asleep in the other bed.
"You did well," Dusander said quietly. "Did you go back to the house later?"
"Yes. I burned the damned letter. I don't think anyone was too interested in that letter, and I was afraid..."
"I don't know," he shrugged. Unable to tell Dusander, he'd been almost superstitiously afraid about the letter, afraid that maybe someone would wander into the house who could read German, someone who would notice references in the letter that were 10, perhaps 20 years out of date.
"Next time you come, smuggle me in something to drink," Dusander said. "I find I don't miss the cigarettes, but I won't be back again," Todd said flatly. "Not ever. It's the end. We're quits."
quits. Dusanta folded his hands on his chest and smiled. It was not a gentle smile, but it was perhaps as close as Dusanta could come to such a thing. I thought that was in the cards. They're going to let me out of this graveyard next week, or so they promise. The doctor says I may have a few years left in my skin yet. I ask him how many, and he just laughs. I suspect that means no more than 3, and probably no more than 2. Still, I may give him a surprise. Todd said nothing. But between you and me, boy, I have almost given up my hopes of seeing the century turn. I want to ask you about something, Todd said, looking at Dusanta steadily. That's why I came in today. I want to ask you about something you said once. Todd glanced over his shoulder at the man on the other bed, and then drew his chair closer to Dusanta's bed. He could smell Dusanta's smell, as dry as the Egyptian room in the museum. So ask. That wino. You said something about me having experience. First-hand experience. What was that supposed to mean? Dusanta's smile widened a bit. I read the newspapers, boy. Old men always read the newspapers, but not in the same way younger people do. Buzzards are known to gather at the ends of certain airport runways in South America when the crosswinds are treacherous. Did you know that? That is how an old man reads the newspaper. A month ago there was a story in the Sunday paper. Not a front-page story. No one cares enough about bums and alcoholics to put them on the front page, but it was the lead story in the feature section. Is someone stalking Santo Donato's down and out? That's what it was called. Crude. Yellow journalism. You Americans are famous for it. Todd's hands were clenched into fists, hiding the butchered nails. He never read the Sunday papers. He had better things to do with his time. He had, of course, checked the papers every day for at least a week following each of his little adventures, and none of his stew bums had ever gotten beyond page 3. The idea that someone had been making connections behind his back infuriated him. The story mentioned several murders, extremely brutal murders, stabbings, bludgeonings. Subhuman brutality was how the writer put it, but you know reporters. The writer of this lamentable piece admitted that there is a high death rate among these unfortunates, and that Santo Donato has had more than its share of the indigent over the years. In any given year, not all of these men die naturally or of their own bad habits. There are frequent murders. But in most cases, the murderer is usually one of the deceased degenerate's compatriots. The motive no more than an argument over a penny ante card game or a bottle of Muscatel. The killer is usually happy to confess. He is filled with remorse. But these recent killings have not been solved. Even more ominous to this yellow journalist's mind, or whatever passes for his mind, is the high disappearance rate over the last few years. Of course, he admits again, these men are not much more than modern-day hobos. They come and go. But some of these left without picking up welfare checks or day labor checks from Speller Work, which only pays on Fridays. Could some of these have been victims of this yellow journalist's wino killer, he asks? Victims who haven't been found? Ha! Dusanta waved his hand in the air, as if to dismiss such errant irresponsibility. Only titillation, of course. Give people a comfortable little scare on Sunday morning. He calls up old bogies, threadbare but still useful, the Cleveland torso murderer Zodiac, the mysterious Mr. X who killed the Black Dahlia, Spring-Heel Jack, such drivel. But it makes me think. What does an old man have to do but think when old friends don't come to visit anymore? Todd shrugged. I thought, if I wish to help this odious yellow dog journalist, which I certainly do not, I could explain some of the disappearances. Not the corpses found stabbed or bludgeoned, not them, God rest their besotted souls, but some of the disappearances, because at least some of the bums who disappeared are in my cellar. How many down there? Todd asked in a low voice. Six, Dusanta said calmly. Counting the one you helped me dispose of, six.
You're really nutso, Todd said. The skin below his eyes had gone white and shiny. At some point, you just blew all your fucking wheels.
Blew my wheels? What a charming idiom. Perhaps you're right. But then I said to myself, this newspaper jackal would love to pin the murders and the disappearances on the same somebody, his hypothetical wino killer. But I think maybe that's not what happened at all. Then I say to myself, do I know anybody who might be doing such things? Somebody who has been under as much strain as I have during the last few years? Someone who has also been listening to old ghosts rattle their chains? And the answer is yes. I know you, boy. I've never killed anyone. The image that came was not of the winos. They weren't people, not really people at all. The image that came was of himself crouched behind the dead tree, peering through the telescopic sight of his 30-30, the crosshairs fixed on the temple of the man with the scuzzy beard, the man driving the Brat pickup. Perhaps not, Dusanta agreed, amicably enough. Yet you took hold so well that night. Your surprise was mostly anger at having been put in such a dangerous position by an old man's infirmity, I think. Am I wrong?
No, you're not wrong, Todd said. I was pissed off at you, and I still am. I covered it up for you because you've got something in a safety deposit box that could destroy my life.
No, I do not.
What? What are you talking about?
It was as much a bluff as your letter left with a friend. You never wrote such a letter. There was never such a friend, and I have never written a single word about our association, shall I call it. Now I lay my cards on the table. You saved my life. Never mind that you acted only to protect yourself. That does not change how speedily and efficiently you acted. I cannot hurt you, boy. I tell you that freely. I have looked death in the face, and it frightens me, but not as badly as I thought it would. There is no document. It is, as you say, we are quits.
Todd smiled, a weird upward corkscrewing of the lips. A strange sardonic light danced and fluttered in his eyes.
Herr Dusanta, he said, if only I could believe that.
In the evening, Todd walked down to the slope overlooking the freeway, climbed down to the dead tree, and sat on it. It was just past twilight. The evening was warm. Car headlights cut through the dusk in long yellow daisy chains.
There is no document.
He hadn't realized how completely irretrievable the entire situation was until the discussion that had followed. Dusanta suggested Todd search the house for a safety deposit key, and when he didn't find one, that would prove there was no safety deposit box, and hence no document. But a key could be hidden anywhere. It could be put in a Crisco can and buried. It could be put in a Sucrets tin and slid behind a bore that had been loosened and then replaced. He might even have ridden the bus to San Diego and put it behind one of the rocks in the decorative stone wall which surrounded the bear's environmental area. For that matter, Todd went on, Dusanta could even have thrown the key away. Why not? He had only needed it once to put his written documents in. If he died, someone else would take it out. Dusanta nodded reluctantly at this, but after a moment's thought he made another suggestion. When he got well enough to go home, he would have the boy call every single bank in Santo Donato. He would tell each bank official he was calling for his grandfather. Poor grandfather, he would say, had grown lamentably senile over the last 2 years, and now he had misplaced the key to his safety deposit box. Even worse, he could no longer remember which bank the box was in. Could they just check their files for an Arthur Denker, no middle initial? And when Todd drew a blank at every bank in town, Todd was already shaking his head again. First, a story like that was almost guaranteed to raise suspicions. It was too pat. They would probably suspect a con game and get in touch with the police. Even if every one of them bought the story, it would do no good. If none of the almost 9 dozen banks in Santo Donato had a box in the Denker name, it didn't mean that Dusanta hadn't rented one in San Diego, L.A., or any town in between. At last Dusanta gave up.
You have all the answers, boy. All at least but one. What would I stand to gain by lying to you? I invented this story to protect myself from you. That is a motive. Now I am trying to uninvent it. What possible gain do you see in that?
Dusander got laboriously up on one elbow.
For that matter, why would I need a document at all at this point? I could destroy your life from this hospital bed, if that was what I wanted. I could open my mouth to the first passing doctor. They are all Jews. They would all know who I am, or at least who I was. But why would I do this? You are a fine student. You have a fine career ahead of you, unless you get careless with those winos of yours.
Todd's face froze.
I told you. I know. You never heard of them. You never touched so much as a hair on their scaly, tick-ridden heads. All right, good, fine, I say no more about it. Only tell me, boy, why should I lie about this? We are quits, you say, but I tell you we can only be quits if we can trust each other.
Now, sitting behind the dead tree on the slope which ran down to the freeway, looking at all the anonymous headlights disappearing endlessly like slow tracer bullets, he knew well enough what he was afraid of. Dusander talking about trust. That made him afraid. The idea that Dusander might be tending a small but perfect flame of hatred deep in his heart, that made him afraid, too. A hatred of Todd Bowden, who was young, clean-featured, unwrinkled. Todd Bowden, who was an apt pupil with a whole bright life stretching ahead of him. But what he feared most was Dusander's refusal to use his name. Todd. What was so hard about that, even for an old kraut whose teeth were mostly false? Todd. One syllable. Easy to say. Put your tongue against the roof of your mouth, drop your teeth a little, replace your tongue, and it was out. Yet Dusander had always called him boy. Only that. Contemptuous. Anonymous. Yes, that was it. Anonymous as a concentration camp serial number. Perhaps Dusander was telling the truth. No, not just perhaps, probably. But there were those fears, the worst of them being Dusander's refusal to use his name. And at the root of it all was his own inability to make a hard and final decision. At the root of it all was a rueful truth. Even after 4 years of visiting Dusander, he still didn't know what went on in the old man's head. Perhaps he wasn't such an apt pupil after all. Cars and cars and cars. His fingers itched to hold his rifle. How many could he get? 3? 6? An even baker's dozen? And how many miles to Babylon? He stirred restlessly, uneasily. Only Dusander's death would tell the final truth, he supposed. Sometime during the next 5 years, maybe even sooner, 3 to 5. It sounded like a prison sentence. Todd Bowden, this court hereby sentences you to 3 to 5 for associating with a known war criminal. 3 to 5 at bad dreams and cold sweats. Sooner or later, Dusander would simply drop dead. Then the waiting would begin, the knot in the stomach every time the phone or the doorbell rang. He wasn't sure he could stand that. His fingers itched to hold the gun, and Todd curled them into fists and drove both fists into his crotch. Sick pain swallowed his belly, and he lay for some time afterwards in a writhing ball on the ground, his lips pulled back in a silent shriek. The pain was dreadful, but it blotted out the endless parade of thoughts, at least for a while. 20. For Morris Heisel, that Sunday was a day of miracles. The Atlanta Braves, his favorite baseball team, swept a doubleheader from the high and mighty Cincinnati Reds by scores of 7-1 and 8-0. Lydia, who boasted smugly of always taking care of herself and whose favorite saying was, "An ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure," slipped on her friend Janet's wet kitchen floor and sprained her hip. She was at home in bed. It wasn't serious, not at all, and thank God, what God, for that. But it meant she wouldn't be able to visit him for at least 2 days, maybe as long as 4. 4 days without Lydia. 4 days that he wouldn't have to hear about how she had warned him that the stepladder was wobbly and how he was up too high on it in the bargain. 4 days when he wouldn't have to listen to her tell him how she'd always said the Rogan's pup was going to cause them grief, always chasing lover boy that way. 4 days without Lydia asking him if he wasn't glad now that she had kept after him about sending in that insurance application, for if she had not, they would surely be on their way to the poorhouse now. 4 days without having Lydia tell him that many people live perfectly normal lives, almost anyway, paralyzed from the waist down. Why, every museum and gallery in the city had wheelchair ramps as well as stairs, and there were even special buses. After the observation, Lydia would smile bravely, and then inevitably burst into tears. Morris drifted off into a contented late afternoon nap. When he woke up, it was 5:30 in the afternoon. His roommate was asleep. He still hadn't placed Denker, but all the same, he felt sure that he had known the man at some time or other. He'd begun to ask Denker about himself once or twice, but then something kept him from making more than the most banal conversation with the man. The weather, the last earthquake, the next earthquake, and yeah, the guide says Myron Florin is going to come back for a special guest appearance this week on the Welk Show. Morris told himself he was holding back because it gave him a mental game to play, and when you were in a body cast from your shoulders to your hips, mental games can come in handy. If you had a little mental contest going on, you didn't have to spend quite so much time wondering how it was going to be pissing through a catheter for the rest of your life. If he came right out and asked Denker, the mental game would probably come to a swift and unsatisfying conclusion. They would narrow their pasts down to some common experience, a train trip, a boat ride, possibly even the camp. Denker might have been in Patton. There had been plenty of German Jews there. On the other hand, one of the nurses had told him Denker would probably be going home in a week or two. If Morris couldn't figure it out by then, he would mentally declare the game lost and ask the man straight out, "Say, I've had the feeling I know you." But there was more to it than just that, he admitted to himself. There was something in his feelings, a nasty sort of undertow, that made him think of that story, The Monkey's Paw, where every wish had been granted as the result of some evil turn of fate. The old couple who came into possession of the paw wished for $100 and received it as a gift of condolence when their only son was killed in a nasty mill accident. Then the mother had wished for the son to return to them. They had heard footsteps dragging up their walk shortly afterward, then pounding on the door. The mother, mad with joy, had gone rushing down the stairs to let in her only child. The father, mad with fear, scrabbled through the darkness for the dried paw, found it at last, and wished his son dead again. The mother threw the door open a moment later and found nothing on the stoop but an eddy of night wind. In some way, Morris felt that perhaps he did know where he and Denker had been acquainted, but that his knowledge was like the son of the old couple in the story, returned from the grave, but not as he was in his mother's memory, returned instead horribly crushed and mangled from his fall into the gnashing, whirling machinery. He felt that his knowledge of Denker might be a subconscious thing, pounding on the door between that area of his mind and that of rational understanding and recognition, demanding admittance, and that another part of him was searching frantically for the monkey's paw, or its psychological equivalent, for the talisman that would wish away the knowledge forever. Now he looked at Denker, frowning. Denker, Denker, where have I known you, Denker? Was it Patton? Is that why I don't want to know? But surely two survivors of a common horror do not have to be afraid of each other. Unless, of course, he frowned. He felt very close to it suddenly. But his feet were tingling, breaking his concentration, annoying him. They were tingling in just the way a limb tingles when you've slept on it and it's returning to normal circulation. If it wasn't for the damned body cast, he could sit up and rub his feet until that tingle went away. He could... Morris's eyes widened. For a long time he lay perfectly still, Lydia forgotten, Denker forgotten, Patton forgotten, everything forgotten, except that tingly feeling in his feet. Yes, both feet. but it was stronger in the right one. When you felt that tingle, you said, my foot went to sleep. But what you really meant, of course, my foot is waking up. Morris fumbled for a call button. He pressed it again and again until the nurse came. The nurse tried to dismiss it. She had had hopeful patients before. His doctor wasn't in the building and the nurse didn't want to call him at home. Dr. Kemmelman had a vast reputation for evil temper, especially when he was called at home. Morris wouldn't let her dismiss it. He was a mild man, but now he was prepared to make more than a fuss. He was prepared to make an uproar, if that's what it took. The Braves had taken two. Lydia had sprained her hip, but good things came in threes. Everyone knew that. At last the nurse came back with an intern, a young man named Dr. Timpnell, whose hair looked as if it had been cut by a lawn boy with very dull blades. Dr. Timpnell pulled a Swiss Army knife from the pocket of his white pants, folded out the Phillips screwdriver attachment, and ran it from the toes of Morris's right foot down to the heel. The foot did not curl, but his toes twitched. It was an obvious twitch, too definite to miss. Morris burst into tears. Timpnell, looking rather dazed, sat beside him on the bed and patted his hand. "This sort of thing happens from time to time," he said, possibly from his wealth of practical experience, which stretched back perhaps as far as 6 months. "No doctor predicts it, but it does happen, and apparently it's happened to you." Morris nodded through his tears. "Obviously you're not totally paralyzed," Timpnell was still patting his hand, "but I wouldn't try to predict if your recovery will be slight, partial, or total. I doubt if Dr. Kemmelman will either. I suspect you'll have to undergo a lot of physical therapy, and not all of it will be pleasant. But it will be more pleasant than, you know." "Yes," Morris said through his tears. "I know. Thank God." He remembered telling Lydia there was no God and felt his face fill up with hot blood. "I'll see that Dr. Kemmelman is informed," Timpnell said, giving Morris's hand a final pat and rising. "Could you call my wife?" Morris asked. Because doom crying and hand-wringing aside, he felt something for her. Maybe it was even love, an emotion which seemed to have little to do with sometimes feeling like you could wring a person's neck. "Yes, I'll see that it's done. Nurse, would you—" "Of course, doctor," the nurse said, and Timpnell could barely stifle his grin. "Thank you," Morris said, wiping his eyes with a Kleenex from the box on the nightstand. "Thank you very much." Timpnell went out. At some point during the discussion, Mr. Denker had awakened. Morris considered apologizing for all the noise, or perhaps for his tears, and then decided no apology was necessary. "You are to be congratulated, I take it," Mr. Denker said. "We'll see," Morris said, but like Timpnell, he was barely able to stifle his grin. "We'll see." "Things have a way of working out," Denker replied vaguely, and then turned on the TV with a remote control device. It was now 5:45, and they watched the last of Hee Haw. It was followed by the evening news. Unemployment was worse. Inflation was not so bad. Billy Carter was thinking about going into the beer business. A new Gallup poll showed that if the election were to be held right then, there were 4 Republican candidates who could beat Billy's brother, Jimmy. And there had been racial incidents following the murder of a black child in Miami. A night of violence, the newscaster called it. Closer to home, an unidentified man had been found in an orchard near Highway 46. Stabbed and bludgeoned. Lydia called just before 6:30. Dr. Kemmelman had called her, and, based on the young intern's report, he had been cautiously optimistic. Lydia was cautiously joyous. She vowed to come in the following day, even if it killed her. Morris told her he loved her. Tonight he loved everyone. Lydia, Dr. Timpnell with his lawn boy haircut, Mr. Denker, even the young girl who brought in the supper trays as Morris hung up. Supper was hamburgers, mashed potatoes, a carrots and peas combination, and small dishes of ice cream for dessert. The candy striper who served it was Felice, a shy, blonde girl of perhaps 20. She had her own good news. Her boyfriend had landed a job as a computer programmer with IBM and had formally asked her to marry him. Mr. Denker, who exuded a certain courtly charm that all the young ladies responded to, expressed great pleasure. "Really? How wonderful. You must sit down and tell us all about it. Tell us everything. Omit nothing." Felice blushed and smiled and said she couldn't do that. "We've still got the rest of the B-wing to do, and C-wing after that. And look, here it is, 6:30. Then tomorrow night for sure. We insist, don't we, Mr. Heisel?
Yes, indeed, Morris murmured, but his mind was a million miles away. You must sit down and tell us all about it.
Words spoken in that exact same bantering tone. He had heard them before.
Of that there could be no doubt. But had Denker been the one to speak them? Had he? Tell us everything.
The voice of an urbane man, a cultured man. But there was a threat in the voice.
A steel hand in a velvet glove, yes.
Where?
Tell us everything. Omit nothing.
Patton?
Morris Heisel looked at his supper. Mr. Denker had already fallen to with a will. The encounter with Felice had left him in the best of spirits. The way he had been after the young boy with the blonde hair came to visit him.
A nice girl, Denker said, his words muffled by a mouthful of carrots and peas.
Oh, yes. You must sit down. Felice, you mean, she's...
And tell us all about it.
Very sweet.
Tell us everything. Omit nothing.
He looked down at his own supper, suddenly remembering how it got to be in the camps after a while. At first you would have killed for a scrap of meat, no matter how maggoty or green with decay. But after a while that crazy hunger went away and your belly lay inside your middle like a small gray rock. You felt you would never be hungry again, until someone showed you food.
Tell us everything, my friend. Omit nothing. You must sit down and tell us all about it.
The main course on Morris's plastic hospital tray was hamburger. Why should it suddenly make him think of lamb? Not mutton, not chops. Mutton was often stringy, chops often tough. And a person whose teeth had rotted out like old stumps would perhaps not be overly tempted by mutton or a chop. No, what he thought of now was a savory lamb stew, gravy-rich and full of vegetables, soft, tasty vegetables. Why think of lamb stew? Why, unless the door banged open? It was Lydia, her face rosy with smiles. An aluminum crutch was propped in her armpit, and she was walking like Marshall Dillon's friend Chester.
"Morris!"
she trilled. Trailing her and looking just as tremulously happy was Emma Rogan from next door. Mr. Denker, startled, dropped his fork. He cursed softly under his breath and picked it up off the floor with a wince.
"It's so wonderful!"
Lydia was almost baying with excitement. "I called Emma and asked her if we could come tonight instead of tomorrow. I had the crutch already, and I said, "Em,"
"if I can't bear this agony for Morris, what kind of wife am I to him? Those were my very words, weren't they, Emma?"
Emma Rogan, perhaps remembering that her collie pup had caused at least some of the problem, nodded eagerly. "So I called the hospital," Lydia said, shrugging her coat off and settling in for a good long visit. "And they said it was past visiting hours, but in my case they would make an exception. Except we couldn't stay too long because we might bother Mr. Denker. We aren't bothering you, are we, Mr. Denker?"
"No, dear lady," Mr. Denker said resignedly.
"Sit down, Emma. Take Mr. Denker's chair. He's not using it. Here, Morris, stop with the ice cream. You're slobbering it all over yourself just like a baby. Never mind, we'll have you up and around in no time. I'll feed it to you. Goo, goo, ga, ga, open wide. Over the teeth, over the gums. Look out, stomach, here it comes. Now, don't say a word. Mommy knows best. Would you look at him, Emma? He has hardly any hair left, and I don't wonder, thinking he might never walk again. It's God's mercy. I told him that stepladder was wobbly. I said, Morris, I said, come down off there before—"
She fed him ice cream and chattered for the next hour, and by the time she left, hobbling ostentatiously on the crutch while Emma held her other arm, thoughts of lamb stew and voices echoing up through the years were the last things in Morris Heisel's mind. He was exhausted. To say it had been a busy day was putting it mildly. Morris fell deeply asleep. He awoke some time between 3 and 4 a.m. with a scream locked behind his lips. Now he knew. He knew exactly where and exactly when he had been acquainted with the man in the other bed. Except his name had not been Denker then. Oh, no, not at all. He had awakened from the most terrible nightmare of his whole life. Someone had given him and Lydia a monkey's paw, and they had wished for money. Then somehow a Western Union boy in a Hitler Youth uniform had been in the room with them. He handed Morris a telegram which read, "Regret to inform you both daughters dead. Stop. Patton concentration camp. Stop. Greatest regrets at this final solution. Stop. Commandant's letter follows. Stop. Will you tell everything and omit nothing? Stop. Please accept our check for 100 Reichmarks on deposit your bank tomorrow. Stop. Signed, Adolf Hitler, Chancellor." A great wail from Lydia. And although she had never even seen Morris's daughter, she held the monkey's paw high and wished for them to be returned to life. The room went dark, and suddenly from outside came the sound of dragging, lurching footfalls. Morris was down on his hands and knees in a darkness that suddenly stank of smoke and gas and death. He was searching for the paw. One wish left. If he could find the paw, he could wish this dreadful dream away. He would spare himself the sight of his daughters, thin as scarecrows, their eyes deep wounded holes, their numbers burning on the scant flesh of their arms. Hammering on the door. In the nightmare, his search for the paw became ever more frenzied, but it bore no fruit. It seemed to go on for years, and then, behind him, the door crashed open. "No," he thought, "I won't look. I'll close my eyes, rip them from my head if I have to, but I won't look." But he did look. He had to look. In the dream, it was as if huge hands had grasped his head and wrenched it around. It was not his daughter standing in the doorway. It was Denker, a much younger Denker, a Denker who wore a Nazi SS uniform, the cap with its death's head insignia cocked rakishly to one side. His buttons gleamed heartlessly. His boots were polished to a killing gloss. Clasped in his arms was a huge and slowly bubbling pot of lamb stew. And the dream Denker, smiling his dark, suave smile, said, "You must sit down and tell us all about it, as one friend to another, eh? We have heard that gold has been hidden, that tobacco has been hoarded, that it was not food poisoning with Schneibel at all, but powdered glass in his supper 2 nights ago. You must not insult our intelligence by pretending you know nothing. You knew everything, so tell it all. Omit nothing." And in the dark, smelling the maddening aroma of the stew, he told them everything. His stomach, which had been a small gray rock, was now a ravening tiger. Words spilled helplessly from his lips. They spewed from him in the senseless sermon of a lunatic, truth and falsehood all mixed together. "Broden has his mother's wedding ring taped below his scrotum. You must sit down. Laszlo and Herman Dorksey have talked about Russian guard tower number 3 and tell us everything. Rachel Tannenbaum's husband has tobacco. He gave the guard who comes on after Zeke, the one they call Booger Eater because he's always picking his nose and then putting his fingers in his mouth, Tannenbaum, some of it to Booger Eater so he wouldn't take his wife's pearl earrings." "Oh, that makes no sense. No sense at all. You've mixed up 2 different stories, I think. But that's all right. Quite all right. We'd rather have you mix up 2 stories then omit one completely. You must omit nothing. There is a man who has been calling out his dead son's name in order to get double rations. Tell us his name." I don't know it, but I can point him out to you, please. Yes, I can show him to you. I will, I will, I will, I will tell us everything you know. I will, I will, I will, I will, I will, I will, I..." until he swam up into consciousness with a scream in his throat like fire. Trembling uncontrollably, he looked at the sleeping form in the other bed. He found himself staring particularly at the wrinkled, caved-in mouth. Old tiger with no teeth. Ancient and vicious rogue elephant with one tusk gone and the other rotted loose in its socket. Senile monster. "Oh, my God," Morris Heisel whispered. His voice was high and faint, inaudible to anyone but himself. Tears trickled down his cheeks toward his ears. "Oh, dear God, the man who murdered my wife and my daughters is sleeping in the same room with me, my God. Oh, dear, dear God, he is here with me now in this room." The tears began to flow faster now, tears of rage.
and horror, hot, scalding. He trembled and waited for morning, and morning did not come for an age.